Mary Ann Colby was a seemingly normal housewife, living in the upscale town of Shaker Heights, Ohio. But she would do something inexplicable on August 24, 1965, that would question how normal she really was when she shockingly murdered an 8-year-old neighbor named John Kramer Young Jr., who was a playmate of her own son. She would claim insanity, despite taking steps to cover up the crime and giving plenty indication that she knew what she was doing. To this day, there are still questions about what could truly cause her to do something so horrific. I'm Joe Schwartz, and this is episode 3 of Behaving Badly, Mary Ann Colby and the Murder of John Kramer Young Jr. Edwin and Ada Couts had only been married for 7 months when they gave birth to their first child, daughter Mary Ann, on January 2, 1925. A second child, a son Wendell, would be born 2 years later. The marriage would be short-lived, though, as the couple constantly fought over finances. Edwin was a fireman in their hometown of Dayton, Ohio, and he tried to insist that Ada get a job as well and put Mary Ann and Wendell into foster care. In 1928, Ada would not only file for divorce from Edwin after just 4 years of marriage, but she would also file a restraining order against him. He would accuse her of having affairs, that Mary Ann and Wendell weren't his own, and Ada was terrified of him potentially harming her. Edwin was granted the privilege of visitation with his two children. However, Mary Ann would not see her father again until nearly 4 decades later. Mary Ann would grow up feeling like a second fiddle to her brother Wendell. Ada appeared to heavily favor him, and according to Mary Ann, she would not make a decision without his approval. Mary Ann was very smart throughout school, but was also very introverted and an outcast among her schoolmates. She only had one friend growing up named Peggy, who would recall that Mary Ann took a lot of teasing from her fellow schoolmates, but she would remain quiet, never having the ability to stand up for herself. She never cared about fitting in with other teenagers. She loved listening to opera, while her contemporaries preferred the swinging big band numbers of Glenn Miller and Benny Goodman. Mary Ann also took no care of her looks, never caring to wear makeup or do her hair. She didn't care about attracting the attention of any boys to date. It wasn't until after she graduated high school that she had her first ever boyfriend, a boy by the name of Bob Colby, who brought out a whole new side of Mary Ann. She started to wear makeup and cared very much about her looks from that point on. Bob was a wonderful boyfriend who treated her with the utmost respect, the polar opposite of what her father had been to her mother. There was, however, one issue that Mary Ann had with her new beau. He was a bit of a mama's boy. Okay, he was a total mama's boy. Mary Ann would complain to her friend Peggy about how much Bob's mother would try to control her son's life and interfere in their relationship. Bob and Mary Ann would marry in 1946, and the following year, Mary Ann insisted that they move out of Dayton to get away from Bob's mother. Despite Bob graduating from the University of Dayton with an engineering degree, the couple started out on hard times. Bob had severe nervous system dermatitis, which had led to a brief stay at Dayton State Hospital, where he would receive electroshock treatment. After leaving the hospital and moving out of Dayton, the couple first moved into a small trailer in a trailer park in Cleveland. Mary Ann was miserable during this period. The trailer's size made a night's sleep challenging enough for her, but on top of that, the electroshock treatment Bob had received would cause him to have nightmares for some time afterwards, and he would kick and thrash about in the night, which led to many sleepless nights for Mary Ann, causing her to feel worn out most days. The couple lived in the small trailer for 5 years, when in 1952, Bob's parents would die, leaving him a substantial inheritance. With the money Bob inherited, as well as the money he made from his job as an engineer in Cleveland, the couple was able to afford to buy a nice new home in nearby Shaker Heights. At the time, Shaker Heights was one of the wealthiest communities in the country. It is also the hometown of legendary actor Paul Newman, best-selling author Celeste Ng. Her book and TV series Little Fires Everywhere is also set in Shaker Heights. And How I Met Your Mother fans out there, it is also the hometown of central character Ted Mosby. Bob and Mary Ann would find what they felt was the perfect home at 3163 Warrington Road. Soon afterwards, Mary Ann began to exhibit obsessive behavior with a man who would later be referred to as only Mr. K. She became romantically infatuated with this Mr. K, despite being married to Bob. She would even tease Bob about how he could never measure up to him, but Bob always let it slide, believing she was just joking around. However, she would constantly call Mr. K, and even followed him on a date he went on with another woman one time. She was practically stalking this man. Mr. K, on the other hand, did not feel any affection towards Mary Ann and had enough of her harassment, to the point that he called Bob and told him what was happening and asked Bob to have Mary Ann leave him alone. Bob confronted Mary Ann on the issue, and she apologized and never bothered Mr. K again. A few years later, in 1955, the couple would welcome their first and only son, Dane, into the family. Neighbors viewed Bob and Mary Ann as nice enough people. However, they didn't tend to socialize with everyone else on the block. In 1958, a new family moved into the home two houses down from the Colbys at 3171 Warrington Road. John and Nancy Young both came from prominent families. John was a chemical salesman, while Nancy was a homemaker and the daughter of a well-known architect. And they had children of their own, including John Kramer Young Jr., who just went by Kramer. Kramer was the same age as Dane Colby, and the two boys quickly became playmates. But as with other residents on Warrington Road, Bob and Mary Ann wouldn't really socialize with the Youngs, despite their two sons being best friends. The boys would spend a lot of time at each other's homes, and Mary Ann had grown quite fond of Kramer. He was a good-looking boy who was really nice and polite. Kramer himself had grown more comfortable with Mary Ann Colby than he was with his own parents. When he was 5, he confided to Mary Ann that he already knew that Santa Claus wasn't real, but was afraid to reveal it to his dad, worried that he would get angry. John Young Sr. was a disciplinarian with a bit of a mean streak. He was the kind of parent who would punish his children if they didn't eat their vegetables at dinner. Kramer would be punished many times for refusing to do so himself. He would find more comfort at the Colby home with Mary Ann's sweet-natured personality. What affection Mary Ann Colby had towards Kramer Young Jr., the same could not be said with how John and Nancy Young thought of Dane Colby. They thought Dane, quote-unquote, didn't measure up with other children in their neighborhood. Nancy said that Dane walked pigeon-toed and spoke in an effeminate manner, and became concerned when Kramer began to mimic Dane's behavior. Then, there was a time Kramer had his birthday party at nearby Horseshoe Lake. John Young became angry with Dane when he began to throw hot dogs into the lake, Dane says because they were burned. Dane was not a mental match for children his age. He was a slow learner. Although he managed to read at the level of a 12-year-old at the age of 8, Dane would also be picked on by other neighborhood kids. Mary Ann, who had never been able to stand up for herself when she was being bullied as a child, would not tolerate anyone criticizing her only born child. She was known for slapping other kids who made fun of Dane. One time, she slapped Kramer's older sister, Beth, after she felt Beth had interfered in a game that Dane was playing. The tension was building between the two families. John Young told Kramer that he didn't want him playing with Dane anymore because Dane, quote-unquote, acted like a baby. Kramer then relayed the comment to Dane, who then went and told his mother. Mary Ann was hurt that anyone would think anything negative of her son and took it all personally. She grew to be resentful towards the Youngs. They thought their little boy was so perfect and special, too good for her boy. Never mind that Kramer had been held back a grade in elementary school due to his dyslexia. He was the perfect, good-looking, all-American boy. Why could no one see the same in her sweet boy, Dane? Perhaps that's what led to her actions on the morning of August 24th, 1965. At 8:30 a.m., Mary Ann called the Young home to say that she had come across a child's jacket in her home that did not belong to Dane, and her description of it matched one that Kramer owned, but had lost months before. Kramer had gotten in a lot of trouble with his father when he lost that jacket. It was a jacket that had been one of Kramer's favorites, that he had picked out himself while on a shopping trip with his father's at a Sears in Cleveland. He was happy now that it had apparently been found. John said that he would send Kramer over to the Colby house to pick it up and sent him on his way. When Kramer didn't immediately return home, his parents thought nothing of it. They figured he had stayed out to play with Dane and other friends who lived nearby. Summer was winding down, and they would be returning to school soon. Let them have their last bit of fun for the season. When it got to be lunchtime and Kramer still wasn't home, John and Nancy began to take notice, but still didn't worry. Then it got to be 12:30, then 1 o'clock. Kramer still wasn't back home. At this point, John began to get irritated. Kramer knew he was supposed to be home at lunchtime, and he wanted to be this late? Well, now he can spend the last few days of summer break grounded. When Kramer still didn't return home at 2 o'clock, real worry began to set in. The family had been calling around, and no one had seen Kramer. Since he was going to Mary Ann's house, they called and asked her if she knew where he was. She responded by saying that Kramer had come by after she called, but Kramer said the jacket wasn't his and then immediately left. John and Nancy then realized that Kramer's bike was still at their home and wondered where he could have gone without it, where no one could find him. Then at 2:15, Shaker Heights police officers showed up to the Young home to give them some horrifying news. Approximately 2.5 hours earlier, at just before noon, a college-aged man named David Griesinger was walking his dogs down Gates Mills Boulevard in the suburb of Gates Mills, just 10 miles to the east of Shaker Heights. As he tended to do with the dogs, he turned to walk them along a path through a wooded area on the side of the road, and he wouldn't get far before he would spot the body of a young boy dead in the woods. The shoes on the boy contained a camp label with the name Kramer the Lion on it. Griesinger had come across the body of Kramer Young Jr. He ran back home and called the police. Gates Mills Police Chief Fred Fenor arrived to examine the scene. He noted that the body was not dirty and the clothes were straight. He was, quote-unquote, as neat as a pin. Venora said, quote, "It looked as though he was placed almost tenderly on the grass between two trees," end quote. His first impression was that Kramer had been hit on the head with a rock or had been hit by a car and placed there. He would find out later at the morgue that he had in fact been shot in the back of the head. Now at 2:15, the police were at the home of the Young family and said that they believed they had Kramer down at the morgue and that John Sr. would need to go with them for an identification. When told that Kramer had been found in Gates Mills, John was perplexed. There was absolutely no way that Kramer had walked all the way to Gates Mills on his own. Someone had to take him there. That's when investigators began to look at the last person known to see Kramer alive, Marianne Colby. And immediately, inconsistencies began to show in her story. When she had received the earlier phone call from John inquiring about Kramer's whereabouts, she had said that Kramer did come inside briefly before leaving. Now she was telling the police that she had met Kramer in the driveway of the home, not inside the house. It was enough to make the police want to bring Marianne in for more questioning. On September 1st, Marianne was interviewed at the station, and this time, she said she knew the truth about how Kramer had been killed. Her son Dane had found the gun in the Colby home and had accidentally shot his friend. Marianne had been assured that if Dane had accidentally shot Kramer, then there would likely be no consequences, because under Ohio law, a child under 14 is presumed incapable of murder because a child that young could not fully understand the evil intent to commit murder. If somehow he did have evil intent, then he would be sentenced as a juvenile. After this reveal, police asked for the gun to be taken in as evidence and to run some tests on it. Marianne then led them to a freezer in the basement where she had hidden the gun in some ground meat. Yeah, I know, I'll talk more about that later. After the police retrieved the gun, they began to run some tests to determine if it could really have been Dane who had pulled the trigger. They, however, determined that Dane, at his young age and physical capabilities, would not have had the force strength necessary to be able to fire the gun. So on September 3rd, Marianne was questioned again, and when told the details about how Dane couldn't have pulled the trigger himself, Marianne admitted this time that she had, in fact, been the one who shot Kramer, but it had been an accident. Her story was that the two boys were playing in the house, and she was coming down the staircase carrying a basket of laundry with the gun on top. The gun fell out of the basket, and it fired and hit Kramer in the back of the head. Police obviously found the story ridiculous, but they were curious about what she did from that point on. She said that she had panicked and wrapped Kramer in an old winter coat, then took him out to her car and laid him on the floor in the front passenger seat. At 8:45, a neighbor had seen the Colby's Buick exit the driveway. Marianne drove to the spot of Gates Mills to dump the body. She then tried to remove the remaining four bullets in the gun, and when she couldn't, instead fired them at the ground. She then went home, went down to the basement, took a large package of ground meat out of the refrigerator down there, and buried the gun inside the meat and placed it in the freezer. She then took the coat that she had used to wrap up Kramer's body and burned it in the incinerator. She then took Dane back out and drove towards Cleveland to the Baptist Nursing Home on Chestnut Hills Road, where her mother Ada worked as a nurse. She picked up Ada, drove to the neighborhood supermarket, where Ada and Dane would wait together in the car, while Marianne went inside to buy items for dinner that night. After shopping, she dropped Ada off at the nursing home again, and then returned home and began calling friends and neighbors to invite them to an upcoming birthday party for Dane. Everyone she called later said that she sounded normal and like nothing was out of the ordinary. Even though the authorities had gotten Marianne to admit that she had been the one who shot Kramer, they still weren't buying the story about it being an accident. Powder burns on the back of Kramer's head determined that the gun had been fired from approximately 2 inches away. Marianne was placed under arrest and charged with first-degree premeditated murder. The Colby family lawyer, Charles Dura, set Marianne up to be represented by Gerald Gold, a charismatic and smart 34-year-old lawyer who graduated second in his law school and had just quit as county public defender to join a prominent firm. When he arrived at the station to confer with his client, he immediately began to raise hell because they would not allow him access to her. This would allow him to later win a motion to have her confession thrown out by Judge John J. Corlett, because she had been kept from seeing Gold when she made the confession. Judge Corlett would deny Gold's motion for bail, stating, quote, "I never give bail in capital murder cases." The first strategy that Gerald Gold tried using to spare his client the death penalty was attempt to get the charge reduced to second-degree murder. Assistant County Prosecutor George Mascarino went to the Youngs with the request, but they rejected it, saying that they and the rest of the neighborhood, quote-unquote, wanted Marianne dead. The only option that Gold had at this point was to now go with the insanity defense under the McNaughton rules. For those unfamiliar with the McNaughton rules, they are based on a case from England in 1843, in which a man named Daniel McNaughton murdered Edward Drummond, who was a private secretary to British Prime Minister Robert Peel, by shooting him in the back. McNaughton had claimed that he had intended to assassinate Robert Peel and was under the impression that he had done so when he shot Drummond. His defense would be that his delusions led to a moral breakdown and loss of self-control, so he could no longer be held responsible for his actions. He had medical witnesses testify for him that his delusions deprived him of all restraint over his own actions. After hearing enough, the judge called the trial and instructed the jury to render a not guilty verdict. Daniel McNaughton would spend the rest of his life in a mental institution. Now, that would be the strategy used by Jerry Gold in Marianne Colby's case, that she had been rendered temporarily insane and could not be held accountable for her actions. The prosecution would argue this claim by stating Marianne's actions leading up to the murder and the steps she took to cover it up would prove that she knew what she was doing all along. She had preloaded the gun. She called the Young home to lure Kramer over. She drove 10 miles outside of town to dispose of the body and then burn the coat she used to wrap him in. She hid the gun in a place that the police would never think to look. She tried to pin the killing on Dane when she realized she was caught. The trial would begin on Monday, March 14th, 1966. Marianne Colby waived her right to a trial by jury, so a panel of three judges, Judge Donald F. Liebarger, Judge John Manos, and Judge John Angelotta, would determine her fate. In the opening statement, the prosecution gave Marianne's motive for murder as resenting John and Nancy Young for trying to keep Kramer away from Dane, and jealousy that her son didn't measure up with theirs. For the insanity defense, the defense relied on a clinical psychologist and two psychiatrists to determine Marianne's mental state at the time of the murder. The first expert, Dr. Lily Brunschwig, a clinical psychologist at Cleveland's University Hospitals, diagnosed Marianne as a paranoid schizophrenic. She had done the Rorschach inkblot test to evaluate Marianne and described her interpretation of one image normally viewed as representing circus clowns or dogs, quote, "I see two Scotty dogs. The foot and leg of one and the other are injured and bleeding. Their noses are tied together with a rag, like some person did this deliberately to hurt them," end quote. Dr. Arthur L. Rosenbaum, a psychiatrist at University Hospitals, testified that Marianne could not distinguish between right and wrong at the time of the shooting. He concluded that her homicidal tendencies were of long standing, and that when she purchased the gun, she did so with the intention of killing the unmarried man, Mr. K, who had rejected her advances. Although over time, rumors would begin to circulate that John Young Sr. had been the man she was infatuated with and had murdered Kramer as revenge for his rejection. But John Young, having been the object of Marianne's affections, were only rumors indeed. The state's final expert, psychiatrist Charles A. DeLeon, described Marianne as aggressive, brutal, and remorseless, and suffering from a severe psychosis manifesting itself in confused thinking divorced from reality. Even the state's expert witnesses provided substantial support for a finding of legal insanity. Dr. David Sprague of the psychiatric department at Lakewood Hospital portrayed Marianne as a borderline person who swung between normal and psychotic behavior. He could not rule out the possibility that, quote, disturbed thinking played a part in her act. On Friday, March 26th, just less than 2 full weeks after her trial began, the judges had their ruling: not guilty by reason of insanity. Judge Liebarger concluded the ruling by saying, quote, "Mrs. Colby, we leave you to heaven," end quote. The crowd in the courtroom and public were stunned by the ruling. John Young, beside himself with the verdict, said, "Leave her to heaven? What is that supposed to mean?" She had been acquitted, but was still ordered to be taken to the Lima State Hospital for the criminally insane. On November 16, 1966, Bob Colby divorced Marianne and was granted full custody of Dane. Bob sold the home at 3163 Warrington Road and moved with Dane to Euclid, Ohio. Marianne would be confined to the mental institution in Lima, but it would only be 5 years before another controversy would occur. It had been determined by the staff at the hospital in 1971 that not only was Marianne no longer criminally insane, but in fact, she had never been criminally insane. She filed a writ of habeas corpus, saying there were no legal grounds to hold her at the institution any longer, and the judge agreed, and Marianne Colby was released from the Lima State Hospital for the criminally insane in November of 1971. Her son Dane soon reconnected with her after she was released and wanted to go live with her. The two of them moved to Dublin, Ohio, just outside of Columbus, where she would become the common law wife of a World War II veteran, Russell Cordell, whom she would spend the rest of her life with, living a normal life, after she and Dane joined the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Marianne Colby died March 26, 2007, at the age of 82. Dane Colby lives in Hilliard, Ohio, and to this day, he has never given his account of what happened on the day of the murder. It's inconceivable to think what could cause a seemingly normal suburban housewife to just one day murder an 8-year-old neighbor. The rumor that goes around still is that it was her revenge for the boy's father spurning her affections. Again, that turned out not to be true. The common explanation is that she viewed her son Dane as a very special boy and just couldn't fathom how anyone could be critical of him, as John and Nancy Young were. Kramer Young Jr. was seen as the handsome, perfect, all-American boy, while they thought Dane could never measure up. So it's believed that she decided if Dane could never be as special as Kramer, then Kramer was just too good for this world, so she had to take him out of it. In the end, it's a tragic story of a life cut short, and even more tragic, that there could never be any true justice in the end. Thank you everyone for listening to this week's episode. Sources for this episode were the book The Insanity Defense and the Mad Murderess of Shaker Heights by William L. Tabak, as well as an episode of the podcast Most Notorious, where host Eric Ravines interviews Tabak about the case. I also refer to the page for this case on Murderpedia. All links are included in the show notes. If you like what you heard, please be sure to rate, review, and share this podcast. Stay tuned for a promo for one of my favorite true crime podcasts, The Trail Went Cold. And I will talk to you all next time. Until then, behave yourselves.
Hello everyone, this is Robin Warder, host of the true crime podcast, The Trail Went Cold. If you grew up watching the classic television show Unsolved Mysteries, then this is the podcast for you. Each week, I profile a new unsolved murder or missing persons case and share all the baffling details. Afterward, I provide my own personal analysis and theories about what might have happened. This is a show for true crime buffs who are fascinated by cold cases and love to discuss them and pick them apart in an attempt to figure out the truth. So be sure to check out our podcast to learn about some truly bizarre unsolved mysteries where the trail went cold.
She loved listening to opera, while her contemporaries preferred the bing. Oh, boy.